You know, it's not as big as people say. The Master. Oh, yes, it was. In the Master's house there were, as the saying goes, many mansions. From the outside it was an expensive but not extraordinary stuccoed North London home. Pillars, railings, a modest flight of steps, the bottom floor picked out in arsenic green. Inside, it plunged down into a huge basement, leapt up four floors to a gigantic roof terrace hidden from prying eyes by frosted glass, and writhed back into what had once been a substantial garden, with a clutter of new rooms. Sadie ruled the upper areas, where she had two wardrobe rooms, her own bathroom and a study, and where the shared bedroom was situated. The Master reigned in the lower depths, where he had a gymnasium, a library, a home cinema, and right at the back and deepest down what he called his war room, and Sadie called the playroom. It wasn't a study in the normal sense. One wall was given over to an enormous whiteboard covered with a mind-dazing scatter of words, symbols, arrows, question marks and numbers, often with dollar or euro signs in front of them in red, green, black and blue marker pen. If this was the war room, and that was the battlefield, it seemed to be a battle limited to obsessive and greedy mathematical philosophers. The Master understood every square inch of it. He likened it to the plot of an enormously complicated and daring novel, which instead of writing down with the aim of eventual publication, he was choreographing in real time. His characters living, three-dimensional people whose fates he plotted from his basement. The different colours represented different plot lines. The red was about ridding the country and the party of Olwyn Grimaldi. Blue and green represented the intertwining trajectories and careers of the children through whom he intended to rule again. And the money, mostly in black marker pen, was money. "More tripe than trollop, more dick than Dickens," had been Sadie's mordant observation. Like most marriages, theirs was a complex collusion of self-interest, love, irritation, and shared secrets. And the truth was that Sadie admired her husband's subterranean script-writing and plotting. It would only ever harm their enemies, and it kept him away from the corrupt foreign leaders and cynical tycoons who were always trying to inveigle him abroad. Sadie wasn't even particularly concerned about Ella. She regarded her husband's needs in that respect as a pathetic, boyish weakness rather than a threat to her own position. Ever since they'd first met in a publishing house where she had been working and he had been applying the finishing touches to the first volume of his autobiography, he'd been 23 at the time and not even elected to Parliament, she had enjoyed moulding him from an embarrassingly callow, puppyish enthusiast into the wealthy and powerful man he had become, and who he remained today. Nobody knew his flaws better than Sadie. As to his mistakes, they had mostly made them together. Sometimes she thought she regarded him more as a wayward son than a husband, but in that spirit she liked the work he did downstairs. Now she was standing on the stairs, looking down into the playroom where the Master was sprawled on a low leather sofa, wearing only jogging pants, staring at the whiteboard. "He's a bit of a cow's ass," she said. "I can't bear him. I don't want him anywhere near me. Promise me that," he said, and groaned. "He has issues. He has physical problems. Be a little charitable. You don't have to speak to him. They're all cow's asses. Michael, Clive, Paul, the lot of them. Why do we need Peter Quint?" "Because people listen to him. Don't ask me why. He flips and flops all over the place, but he's sly and he knows the smell of a news story. When you told him to get behind David Petrie, he wrote a couple of brilliant pieces. He even went up to Scotland for the background. Petrie would never have had the pick-up he's been given by the Tory press and the broadcasters if it hadn't been for our Mr. Quint. If you're going to pick a cow's arse, at least pick the one the rest of the herd sniffed. The master tugged absent-mindedly at his belly hair, then swiveled in the sofa and looked hard at his wife. You really think we should do this? After all this time, you think we should switch horses? Well, darling, we started off with quite a sizable herd of them, didn't we? And now we're riding just two. If we make the right choice, we'll have the party under the thumb of somebody who understands how the world works again, who's prepared to take unpopular decisions. But I needn't tell you all that. It's your speech. She walked down the stairs and across the room to one of the master's desks, from which she picked up a carefully folded piece of chamois leather. Petrie is, I'm told, a man for the ladies. He's got some good ideas, but he's volatile, flamboyant. I think he's brittle. Caroline Phillips, on the other hand, has the perfect backstory for here and now. A gay woman with a stable partnership and a strong religious background. She's going to be our Margaret Thatcher, depend on it. So it's time to simplify the story. And she walked up to the whiteboard and, before the master could stop her, swiped out a square meter of squiggles which had prominently included the letters DP. The master, however, was master of his own whiteboard, if not his house. He unfolded himself with the athleticism of the Pilates addict and reinserted Petrie's name in red ink, albeit with a question mark after it. I like him, he said to himself. He's got an inner anger. He's not quite predictable. Anyway, where's the fun in a one-horse race? Then he changed colour, the blues and greens, and began to draw arrows and squiggles and to add further words. They included Grand Project, Rome, and Ella Leverage. Like all bad writers, the master suffered from a lifelong addiction to exclamation marks. Family life.